Welcome to episode 222 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's program, we have as our featured guest, professor and author Daniel Lowe. And we talk with Daniel Lowe about his recently published debut novel titled All That's Left to Tell. He shares a lot of great bits of it with us. Very compelling. And we talk about also themes of persistence and what it means to tell stories and how important to our humanity that is. We talk about writing and teaching too. Daniel Lowe on this week's episode. We also have another finely crafted and well-read essay by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare. That piece is titled Skateaway Blues. We have an EW short essay by yours truly entitled Humanity and a poem titled The Weight. And all of this, of course, is ensconced within, as is always the case, several great tunes. Thank you so much for being with us. Let's get to it. Episode 222 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
Thank you.
Humanity. I suppose there is a common theme here. Humanity. What is humanity? What does it mean? What does it entail? Is it some way as extreme as those of the Jane? If one sees a snail, it should be allowed to prevail with its life. You won't squish it. Or is it more about the moral conscience to not bomb or counter-bomb other human beings to win, to send a message? Is humanity partly about debauchery and kill and maim, partly morally inept, intellectually insane? Are we supposed to, for a greater good, accept, remember, talk with one another, despite past pain and conflict, disagreement and wayward confusion? Persistence to better understand ourselves and each other, or a more narrow pursuit of survival and conquest of that which fulfills an individual or country's collective vision of success, righteousness, and outright winning? I suppose humanity is about love and sinning.
When the road gets dark, you can no longer see. Let my love throw a spark and have a little faith in me. And when the tears you cry are all you can believe, give these loving arms a try, baby, and have a little faith in me. 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 Have a little faith in me. Cannot speak so easily. Coming down from a whisper star to have a little faith in me. And when your back's against the wall, just turn around and you'll see. I will catch you far. So have a little faith in me. And have a little faith in me. Baby, have a little faith in me. And have a little faith in me.
Hello. Is this Daniel Lowe?
Yes, it is.
Oh, thank you so much, sir, for being on Troubadours and Rock on Tours with EW Conundrum Demure. It's nice to have you on.
My pleasure to be with you, EW.
Let's get started first by letting people know who we're talking with. I'm sure some people do, but some may not. We're talking with Daniel Lowe, professor, author. He writes and works and lives near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His fiction and poetry have appeared in West Branch, the Nebraska Review, the Montana Review, the Wisconsin Review, the Writing Room, the Bridge, the Patterson Literary Review, Ellipsis, Blue Stem, Midway Journal, and the Madison Review. And he has a novel that debuted very recently titled All That's Left to Tell, and it is getting some great reviews. It's nice to have you on the program.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
So I'd like to get right in to, I read the essay that my associate producer, Dr. Pavese, shared, and it was wonderful. And
thank you.
Yeah, I haven't picked up the book yet, but I plan on it. It sounds like it'd be a great read. The essay on persistence, the lessons of a middle-aged debut novelist.
Yes.
Yeah, you talk about persistence. You talk about Reggie, I believe.
Yes, former student.
Former student. And, you know, I guess I'll just let you take it from here. You want to tell us a bit about, first of all, the essay, then we'll get into the book a bit. I suppose they kind of intermingle. But persistence.
Yes. The essay was actually born out of the writing of the novel, and I wanted to take some time to consider, what it meant to me to publish this novel, which was really something of a surprise later in my life. I started writing way back in high school and pursued it through my college years and through a graduate degree. And I graduated from the University of Pittsburgh in 1983 with an MFA in fiction writing, with the intent of continuing my writing career and being a writer. But like many people in the arts and many writers, you have to find a way to make a living and feed yourself and your family while you're trying to do that work. And so I began teaching, and I did what many postgraduates do who pursue degrees in English writing, and that is I taught writing at various places, some universities, at community colleges and places like that. And I did that for quite a number of years, almost 10 years, before I finally landed a full-time position as a community college professor. And to be honest with you, EW, when I introduced myself to people I haven't met, I introduce myself not as a writer, but as a community college professor, it's that way that I think about myself. I've been teaching at a community college for 25 years, and anyone who has attended a community college or who has taught at a community college knows that the experience is by some measure different than the experience you might have at a university or a four-year college.
And I'd like to interject at this moment,
sure.
Just let you know and listeners know if they don't know. That's my day job, too. I'm a community college professor. So, yeah.
Very good.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. You know well what I'm talking about. That your listeners may not, but you and I both know that most community colleges are open enrollment institutions, and so there are no SAT scores or minimum ACT score requirements to attend, and so you essentially take all comers, and many times those are a high percentage of, well, not the higher percentage, but a very significant percentage of students are those who are adult learners, students who have come back to school after anywhere from 3 to 5 to 15 to 35 years away. And it's been I guess part, I guess the best way to say it is a significant portion of my life's work has been working with all community college students, but the ones that leave a significant impact on me are those adult students, like the ones I mentioned in the essay, like Reggie, who have returned to school, who have faced some pretty rough circumstances in their lives and are trying to map a new course for them with varying degrees of success. And I think, you know, in the essay, I want to make particularly clear that I don't align myself socioeconomically with these students because, you know, I have the privilege of making a decent salary as a community college professor and have been able to, you know, raise my children and so on successfully on the salary that I've earned. But I think, in terms of, some of the struggles that students have to get an education, to graduate, pursue a perhaps dream deferred is somewhat similar to my own experience trying to pursue a writing career with varying degrees of success and usually success that was extraordinarily modest. And while I may not be able to empathize at times with my students who, you know, are coming from often working class backgrounds, sometimes from blighted neighborhoods, sometimes from schooling that was inadequate or insufficient or literally built school buildings that were broken down. You know, I haven't had those experiences, but I have had the experience of struggling to try to fulfill a dream, and I see that in my adult students, and I admire their tenacity against what I consider to be significant odds at success. So that's what kind of led me to write the essay upon reflection upon the sort of eve of the publication of the book to look at my own long road to arriving at that point and recognizing the long roads that my students travel as well.
And the long road you're talking about is actually getting a book published?
Yes. You know,
you're in your 50s? Are you in your 50s now?
Yes, I'm in my 50s. I'm almost 60 years old. And you know, it's interesting. It mirrors sometimes adult students. As I said years ago, or many years ago, back in the early 80s, I graduated with my MFA and sort of fancied myself a writer. And I would, at that time, I continued to write, attempted to publish short stories. But, you know, life, the other elements of life get in the way. And it is, I wasn't ever able I didn't want to prioritize my writing over spending time with my children. I had a strong sense of, you know, duty about teaching students in the classroom. And when you're busy being a father and you're busy teaching, it can be difficult to find time to write. And there were stretches of those years where I kind of gave up entirely. I stopped writing fiction. I would maybe write a handful of poems a year. I'd send them out to literary magazines here and there. And, you know, and sometimes they'd be accepted, but often they would be rejected. I have had that very common experience that writers have of being experiencing a lot of just form rejections and things like that.
But this book was something different, though.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could account for the reason why this book was, you know, successful and the other manuscripts that I had written were not, because I had produced, in the last 12 or 13 years, a couple of novel manuscripts and a couple of collections of short stories. But, you know, I guess one serves one apprenticeship one way or the other in this kind of thing. And after many years, I I sent this book out to a group of agents. An agent jumped right on it. He worked with me on it for 6 months, and then he went and shopped at publishers, and it was taken within a few days. And I have to tell you, I was very pleased, of course, and also astonished. It was something at this point in my life, I had not expected.
And it's titled All That's Left to Tell, which sort of is poignant given what you just described.
Yeah, it's a novel that is really about storytelling as much as anything. The premise is that a man who is whose marriage is just dissolved has sort of fled the country. He is a businessman who works for Pepsi Corporation, and he has gone to Pakistan to work in their offices in Karachi. But while he is there, his estranged 19-year-old daughter is killed, and he, because of his sort of psychological state while he is there, he does not come home for the funeral, and he starts wandering in neighborhoods that he shouldn't wander in, and a unnamed group captures him. And the book opens at that point, and he is being interrogated while blindfolded by a woman who is American, but who is aligned with this group in Karachi, Pakistan. And really, it sort of has that socio-political overtone, but it really is not a novel about that. What happens eventually is she comes to talk to and interrogate him while he is blindfolded, and she kind of takes an interest in him because she discovers what has happened to her daughter. I mean, to his daughter, excuse me. And then they start telling each other stories, and the man who is blindfolded, whose name is Mark, tells stories of his lost daughter and his memories of her to Josephine, who's his interrogator. And what Josephine does is create stories to tell Mark as if his daughter had lived. And so she creates stories of his daughter, whose name is Claire, that as if she was in her 30s and had a child and was on a road trip. And so the novel really develops over the course of its pages in their exchanging of these kinds of stories. I think the premise of telling of those stories, beyond the sort of solace we find in storytelling, is that both of these individuals have suffered significant losses in their lives, and the novel sort of runs on the premise that grief can be both a generative force in our lives and also a very destructive force in our lives. And I think that if there's an overriding theme for the novel, that's it.
Wow. That was great. That's very compelling to hear. I'm very curious as to see how that works out between Mark and Josephine.
It's a different sort of book. I hope I'm not patting myself on the back and saying that. It is.
Well, yeah.
It's a novel that sort of works on various levels, my hope, I guess every writer's hope, is that it rests with their audience, and that they sort of think about it consciously and subconsciously in the wake of finishing.
Yeah, that's what a good book does to you. Or, you know, if you watch a film and 3 days later you're still thinking about some of the characters
exactly
in the storyline.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it was good.
Yeah.
Memories, estrangement, excuse me. And I was reading a little research on you that Dr. Pavis shared, and I saw also that you mentioned, and I think you hit on it, that not talking could be an issue with people too.
You mean in terms of not talking about their experiences and so on.
Yeah, how that could be almost a sort of, unless I misunderstood it, it could be almost like a sort of violence when people refuse to talk to each other.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think that that's very true, and I think it's true in, you know, it's interesting that you should mention that, because I think it's true in the novel that I have the novel I wrote, and also to a smaller extent, true in the essay that you referenced. The novel itself has there's so many sort of imagined scenes in the novel, but there are strong elements of violence that exist in the novel, and some of them some of it is fairly graphic. It's not like it's a horror film or anything, but some of it is fairly graphic, and it is in the telling of those stories, of the characters, the stories, that I think that the characters find relief.
Yeah.
Josephine says that at one point in the novel that she says she doesn't like the word radicalized because she would be someone who's perceived as radicalized. And she says that she's radicalized by grief. But is sort of in telling the stories that she tells to Mark that clearly she gets, even though the stories are not necessarily comforting, she gets comfort from telling those stories. And I think yes, in our silences, when we turn away from telling our stories and speaking them, that is when unresolved. I suppose I'm over-psychologizing, but unresolved conflict can build in us and cause us to strike out. And better to do that in terms of story than to do in actuality. And in the essay, too, I mean, in the essay I wrote with regard to Reggie, who didn't speak a lot about his individual experiences, but who had a difficult time, but he found, this is just kind of another side reference, but an essay written by the Pittsburgh writer John Edgar Wideman about his brother Robbie, who John Edgar Wideman is a highly decorated writer, and his brother is in prison for the rest of his life for his involvement in a crime during which another man was killed, and his the book that he wrote about that experience is really about him and his brother sitting down while his brother's in prison for the first time in their entire lives and really telling each other stories about their lives. And so the experience that Wideman has, the experience that Reggie had to a certain extent, and certainly the experiences of the characters in the books and some of my own experiences about the importance of storytelling at the kind of, it can be a force of good and something that we cling to in times of in difficult times, in times of hardship.
Yeah, and I see it as, in the way you're describing it, for the person who is telling the story, it helps them while they are telling it, and also for the person hearing the story, as well as for the two of them together by sharing.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think, storytelling goes back so far, whether it comes through, in drama or song or poetry, so many peoples over the course of human history have cherished and held to their stories at extraordinary risk to themselves, to the faith that they may have, to their families. They've passed on these stories and told these stories, and I think that the stories are in incredibly important to individuals, and many people literally risk their lives to preserve their own stories, or the stories of their homeland, the stories of their people, the stories of their culture, the stories of their tribe, whichever words you'd like to use in that context, and I think that speaks to their power. I think it speaks to their comfort. I mean, we can sit down with people very different than we are. Even someone like Reggie in the essay, whose experiences in life were very different than my own. And we can talk about some of our experiences and exchange stories of our own and find ways of connecting, because while the stuff of our stories or the specifics, the you know, images, what the characters of our stories might be very different from one another, often are the themes of those stories and the experiences, no matter how far apart we may live figuratively or geographically. Like you said, it provides a moment of connection, of sympathy, if not empathy, of understanding. And if we can, it is idealistic, but it is also hopeful to say, if we can listen to each other's stories and truly listen and find a sort of connection in the human condition when we exchange those stories, I think that we grow as individuals, and no matter what period in our lives we may be in when we hear those stories.
It's just like you, the U.S. Congress, basically.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what.
I figured I'd make you laugh.
Yeah, so they're getting along so well. In fact, as we speak, they just did away with the
filibuster.
Filibuster for Supreme Court nominees. I think
it's the antithesis of what you're speaking of.
Yes, exactly right. It's interesting because we live in an era where, at least at this political moment, that we seem. And I'm as guilty of it as anybody. It's very, very difficult to listen to the stories of others whose points of view are so dramatically different than yours, who could support, who have supported a candidate like my own parents, for instance, like Donald Trump, and still find common ground and comfort and human connection. I mean, it is a particularly interesting moment in history, I think, in that capacity.
It truly is. But the humanity is where it all we have to rely, where we have to go, and that's what you're speaking of. I mean, that every aspect of your essay that you've explained and of the novel that you've shared, it's really about the humanity. And once that's lost, everything else is just empty talk or, exchange of sentences and barbs. But the humanity is not there, it seems. That's key. Wouldn't you say?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, in the novel, there are two minor characters who are Pakistani, and they both are, they speak, a different language than they speak Urdu. They don't speak much English, unlike Josephine, who's his chief interrogator. But they're two male characters who, kind of watch him when she is not there. I don't have experience in living in Pakistan. I haven't visited Karachi. And so it was a bit of an adventure to presume that I might know, well enough to write about these characters. But one character is sort of involved with this organization reluctantly. He has a child of his own and he needs to make some additional money. Another character who watches him is slightly more militant and but he too has suffered a loss and he's lost his wife. If I am able to, I worked and struggled to write those characters in a way so they wouldn't seem wooden or two-dimensional, as too often we see, people who from other nations, especially from other cultures, other faiths. I wanted to be able to imagine them in their lives and their struggles, and give them a sense of, as you put it, humanity that would be recognized despite their involvement in the work that they're doing as terrorists, as people would call them, at least terrorists. And you know, I guess I think that's so critically important. You know, someone might say to me, "Well, how in the world would you be able to write about two, you know, men who lived in Karachi and lived in poverty their entire lives?" And that's a legitimate question because I haven't had that experience. But you know, if we surrender our capacity to extend our imagination to try to imagine the lives that others who are very, very different than us live, well, we have surrendered something, I think, extraordinarily important. And our futures are bleak indeed. I mean, if we can no longer imagine what it might be like to live the way someone significantly different than us lives. And, you know, I think that's one of the great things about writing, is that you have the opportunity to extend your imagination and try to enter the minds of characters who might be fundamentally different than you, and yet, you know, I think it broadens and extends your own sense of what it means to be human and all that that involves.
Beautiful.
It's just critical that we are able to imagine the lives of others. And one of my chief criticisms, just to go back quickly to the political thing with Donald Trump, is he seems to be, you know, utterly incapable of imagining what it's like to be someone other than himself. I don't know what leads a person to become, to have that perspective, but those people I find most troublesome in my private life and indeed in those figures in the public life.
Well put, Professor Lowe. I think we're going to have to leave it there, given the time. But what a wonderful conversation. And I'd like to give you the opportunity to share some contact information so people could track down some of your work.
Sure. That's great.
You have a website or Facebook? Or?
Yes, there is. If you search Facebook and you look up my name, there is an author's page, and you can find my website at my full name, Daniel J. Lowe, Daniel, as you would expect, J-A-Y, Lowe.com. And there's a website there, and there is a contact page there. So people want to send me an email or ask any questions, I certainly would be most pleased to receive those.
And again, Professor Lowe's book titled All That's Left to Tell, recently published, getting really great reviews. I can't wait to pick up my copy. Thank you so much for being on Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Thank you so much, EW. It's been my pleasure.
Take care.
Everything I do gon' be funky from now on, yeah. Everything I do gon' be funky from now on. Just to be myself, I'm gonna do my thing. A little soul can't do no harm, yeah. Cause everything I do gon' be funky from now on, yeah. I've got no class, but I'm doing what I wanna do. So groove with me if you can, or just do what you can do. Oh, shucks.
wire, the house on fire. Wire, the house on fire. Everything I do gon' be funky from now on. Yeah, everything I do gon' be funky from now on. Yeah, never before have I felt so good just being natural me. Minor hang-ups and minor ties, but deep inside I'm free. So let your hair down and get down with it and say what's right or wrong. Yeah, everything I do gon' be funky from now on. Yeah,
everything I do gon' be funky,
yeah,
from now on.
Yeah,
everything I do gon' be funky,
yeah,
from now on. Everything I do gon' be funky from now on.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything I do gon' be funky,
yeah,
from now on.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything I do gon' be funky, yeah, yeah, from now on.
Skate Away Blues. At a Washington Senators game back in the 70s, I spotted a character actor I recognized from television and the movies. He was wearing sunglasses, slightly hammered, and yelling through a popcorn box that conveniently turned into a megaphone. "Are you an actor?" I asked. "I am," he said cheerfully, and gave me his name and some credits. Norman Alden. The name might not ring a bell, but, as with all character actors, the face and the voice would feel as familiar as your next-door neighbor's. He appeared in dozens of TV shows and movies. Notably gruff and burly, he was on everything from The Jack Benny Show, as Man with Iron Bar, to Jerry Lewis's The Patsy, as Bully at the Gym, to Tora, 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 as Major Truman Landon, to Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, as Coach Leroy Fetters. He played a lot of coaches, cops, and other authority figures. My favorite Norman Alden role was Horrible Hank Hopkins in Kansas City Bomber. In that 1972 film, Raquel Welch, the bombshell du jour, played an unlikely roller derby queen, and Alden a wild man player who eventually cracks up and rides around the rink screaming, if memory serves, "Suey," the pig call of the character's native South. This scene alone makes it a classic of roller skating movies. It was something of a golden age for roller skating in popular entertainment. Rollerball, a corporate thriller with James Caan, dramatized the dark side of wheeled entertainment. Xanadu, with Olivia Newton-John and, oddly, Gene Kelly, was a musical about one of the Greek muses who comes to Earth to inspire men and spread the good news of disco. A legendary disaster then, fondly remembered camp now. There has always been a whiff of camp, if not cheese, about roller skating. It conjures the ambiance of the bowling alley and lacks the brisk flair and romance of ice skating. Our local roller skating rink, Skateaway, sat on top of Taylor Hill in a borough next to our depressed former coal town. The borough was notable for its abandoned collieries, where once unlucky little boys sorted coal, and burning coal dumps, which glowed night and day, a noxious and unsettling reminder of our past. The roller rink was fairly new, yet still shabby, brightly colored, yet frayed, with an aroma of stale popcorn and shriveled, days-old hot dogs. And, as at a bowling alley, you could rent the roller skates you wore as you rolled round and round beneath the disco ball, amid the colored lights, awash in the pop music of the day. Jimmy, the floor guard, was the star of the rink. He had a pompadour mullet combo, helmet of hair, as adamantine as any blue-haired ladies do, fresh from the beauty parlor. And he wore tight, loud polyester shirts, unbuttoned low on his hairy chest. He glided backwards with his whistle at the ready, followed by schools of teen girls awed by his masculinity and grace. He flirted. They flirted. Perhaps there were brief dalliances with a few of the older girls. I would hope that as a skating guard, he had his professional ethics, like a lifeguard or an airplane pilot. Jimmy benignly swirled around the floor, occasionally roused to whistleblowing, dashing across the rink and stopping on a dime at the sight of ruffians fighting over a giggly girl in a halter top and short shorts. I wonder what became of Jimmy. Is he slouched in an easy chair, his pompadour long gone, his tarnished whistle in a junk drawer, watching cable news in a daze? Or did he follow his heart to San Francisco and live, briefly, a fabulous life far from the coal dumps of his dreary hometown? I was a horrible skater, even after my mother bought me my own skates and I could practice weekly. Early on, I careened around the rink, praying that I wouldn't bash into fellow skaters, particularly the girls, who sped by me like goddesses, trailing the ambrosial scent of cheap perfume. Eventually, I could stay upright and not embarrass myself too much. Nothing fancy, though, not like those annoying show-offs who twirled and curlicued and bobbed and weaved among us slower-moving stooges. A night at Skateaway was divided into types of skating for different groups, with a sign that lit up for each type. All skate, where parents and kids and teens and loners would head on the floor en masse. Foxtrot and waltz, for the old-timers and serious skaters. Kids only, a catastrophic jumble of children of all ages tormenting one another that ended in scrapes and tears and piercing whistles from Jimmy. Couples, the romantic part of the evening, where moody blue lights bounced off the disco ball as lovers clinched and ground loins while slowly advancing on eight wheels to the strains of I Honestly Love You. The most hopeful and painful type was advancing skate, where couples lined up, and when the whistle blew, the moi moved on to the next girl, a primitive form of speed dating, with less talk and just as much anxiety. Every time I had my eye on a particular girl up the line, hoping to make my shaky way past three less tempting girls, the ooga chucka, ooga ooga, ooga chucka of hooked on a feeling began. The lights brightened, the clear floor sign lit up, and the girl of my dreams skated back to her no doubt brutish future mate. So ended another night of heartbreak at Skateaway on the top of Taylor Hill.
Tight and music. all. You know, she used to have to wait around. She used to be the lonely one. But now that she can skate around town, she's the only, only one. No fear alone at night, she's sailing through the crowd. In her ears, his phones are tight and the music's playing loud. She gets rock and roll in a rock and roll station, in a rock and roll.
Crepe Suzette
bird tweet in the budding branch of an April damp tree as footsteps my chihuahua breathes into his gate. I sit back and wait.
I'm waiting for my man. Got $26 in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125, 634, daylight. Wow. Waiting for my man. Hey, white boy, what you doing uptown? Hey, white boy, chasing my women around. Pardon me, sir, it's the furthest thing from my mind. I'm just waiting for a dear friend of mine. Oh, I'm waiting for my man. Here he comes, he's all dressed in black. PR shoes and a big straw hat. He's never early, he's always late. First thing you learn is you always gotta wait a while. I'm waiting for my man. Brownstone, up three flights of stairs. Everybody's pimp, but nobody cares. He got the words, gives you a sweet taste, and you gotta split, cause there ain't no time to waste. Oh, I'm waiting for my man. Hey baby, won't you holler, don't you bawl and shout. I'm feeling good, I'm gonna work it on out. I'm feeling good, feeling so fine. Until tomorrow, well, that's some other time. Oh, I'm waiting for my man. 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 I'm waiting for mommy.
And there you have it, episode 222 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks that made this episode possible. First and foremost, author and Professor Daniel Lowe. Nice talking with you, sir. Make sure you check out his recently published, highly acclaimed novel, All That's Left to Tell. I also like to thank Michael Pavese, Dr. Michael Pavese, our associate producer, and essayist. Also, of course, these wonderful musical artists: Billie Holiday, Joe Cocker, Alan Toussaint, Dire Straits, Garland Jeffries, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. Until next week, take care of yourself, and thanks for listening.